Today is Monday, April 10th. We're going to work on wrapping up the brain information and then moving on into the autonomic and somatic nervous systems.
Okay, so let's start by reviewing the brain lobes. We know there's four main brain lobes on the cerebrum. Starting up here at the front, what lobe is this one? Frontal lobe, good. On the sides? Temporal lobe, good. Toward the back? Occipital. And up here? Parietal lobe, good. So we got four main lobes. They do correspond with those skull bones that we studied way back when. Okay, so let's go through the parts of these lobes and talk about the important function that is housed there. Let's start with the frontal lobe. There's an area called the prefrontal cortex. And what types of things are housed in the prefrontal cortex?
Personality,
definitely. Decorum. Toilet training, good. Interesting thing about that prefrontal cortex, they say it's not fully developed until around age 25. The brain doesn't reach its full maturity, they say, until that age. So kind of interesting that, you know, that portion of the brain is still developing if you're in your late teens or early 20s. Let's talk about the temporal lobe. What kinds of senses are housed there?
Hearing
and smell. Good. So hearing and smell are housed in the temporal lobes. Now, of course, what we're talking about is right hemisphere is going to receive sensory information from the left side of the face. And that type of control is called what?
Contralateral,
yeah. So when your right hemisphere receives sensory info from the left side, that's contralateral control. Good. Let's see. Let's talk about the visual information received by your occipital lobe. There are two portions in your occipital lobe that handle visual info. We have a primary visual cortex, and we have its association area. Which one of those two is the first portion to receive vision?
Primary,
good. So primary means first, right? And that's, of course, the first area to receive vision. Now, once you receive vision at the primary visual cortex, it is then sent to the association area. What happens to it there?
Interpreted,
good. So if a person is blind, where's the damage? Primary, right. If they can see but they don't make sense of what they see, now we know the damage is? Association area, right. So in fact, you do have a primary and association auditory cortex. You've got primary and association visual areas. So we also have primary and association somatic sensory areas too. So in which lobe is somatic sensation housed? Postcentral gyrus, good, and parietal lobe, good. So back here in this parietal lobe, we actually have a region called the somatic sensory cortex. That primary somatic sensory cortex is the first to receive information coming up from your body. So when we look at this picture here, you'll notice there is a mapping to your body, and sensations such as touch and texture, pressure, temperature are going to come up through your spinal cord, through your thalamus, and then get relayed out to this sensory homunculus. So we first receive the information here in this primary cortex. We then send it over here to the somatic sensory association area. What happens to it there?
Interpretation,
that's right. So you make sense of what you felt. I used the example last week of putting your hand in your pocket looking for keys or change. Simply filling objects in there would be received by your primary somatic sensory cortex. Where do you understand the difference between keys and change in your pocket? Yeah, in that association area. So they're working together to help you fully understand what's going on. Okay, one more area we talked about was a motor cortex that involves voluntary motor control. In which lobe is this housed?
Frontal.
Good, that's housed in the frontal lobe. And of course, the frontal lobe has a primary motor cortex and an association area for the motor control. Now keep in mind, this is voluntary motor control, so what types of muscles are we controlling?
Skeletal,
good. So the primary motor cortex is in this little ridge of tissue here. We call it a what? central gyrus, right. And it is separated from the post-central gyrus by a groove known as?
Central sulcus.
Central sulcus, good. So that groove right between the two is called our central sulcus. Okay. So the primary motor cortex is where you originate thought about moving your body. So if you decide to pick up your pen and write, the thought comes from the primary motor cortex. It actually travels down through descending tracts in your spinal cord. We talk about how this crosses over the gray commissure and then comes out the appropriate root of your spinal cord. So all of this is going to originate up here in your primary motor cortex. That's in the precentral gyrus of which lobe?
Frontal lobe.
Frontal lobe, good. And we control what types of muscles from there?
Skeletal.
Skeletal, good. While we're talking about motor control, there is some subconscious motor control that comes from your basal nuclei. So what's an example of some subconscious motor control we do every day?
Breathing,
okay, so I'm going to take the walking example because breathing and blinking are actually housed elsewhere. So subconsciously, you swing your arms when you walk. You're not really aware of doing this, but that is controlled by dopamine, a type of neurotransmitter that operates here in these little gray patches called basal nuclei. Okay. So that was kind of our tour of the cerebrum in class on Wednesday of last week. Do you have any questions on the cerebrum in specific?
Yes. The third column.
Okay. I know at least in what lobe they're located, and in some cases we talked about a specific part, like that primary motor cortex is in your precentral gyrus. So for some of those, I would know very specifically where they're located.
Okay.
Do you need help labeling those? Good. Okay. General interpretive area for most of us is in the left hemisphere, and let me fast forward through these and I'll show you the spot they say it's located in. They say it's roughly over the parietal occipital temporal lobe junction there, but for most of us, the left hemisphere is where we find it located. And so that's where you get visual, auditory, sensory, all that comes together for interpretation. And for most of us, where is the speech center housed? Which hemisphere?
Is it
left?
Left,
yeah. For most of us, it's in the left hemisphere. Let's go back and review some of that information about the other brain regions. We covered that on Wednesday of last week as well. This info is found on page 116. And last Wednesday, I mentioned to you to help you focus on the important parts of this page, look for the bold-faced terms. For instance, under cerebellum, you'll notice for functions, muscle coordination is bolded. Those are the key terms to look for when you're taking test number 4. So we know that muscle coordination has something to do with our inner ear. That's where we do house some of those balance and equilibrium receptors. And we coordinate that through our cerebellum. I was talking last Wednesday about birds having a really large cerebellum, and that's because they're really reliant on balance to help navigate where they're flying. We're less reliant upon that cerebellum than other animals, but nonetheless, it does receive information from the inner ear, and it coordinates with our muscles and joints to make sure that we're smoothly navigating through our environment. Let's see, the diencephalon has three portions, hypothalamus, thalamus, and pituitary gland. Which one of these is a home for homeostasis?
Hypothalamus,
good. We talked about the origin of hunger and thirst coming from the hypothalamus. What are some other functions that reside here? Yep, wake and sleep cycles are housed here. Autonomic nervous system control is housed here. Okay, and this is certainly a part of the body that we're not done talking about. When you come into Bio 211, the very first 2 weeks is covering this in a lot of detail, so we'll be back to talk about hypothalamus later on. Pituitary gland has one very important job. It serves a major role in the endocrine system. What does the endocrine system make? Hormones, good. So this is a big part of the hormonal control of our bodies. And then finally, what is a major job of your thalamus? Good. Relay station for incoming sensory information. There are a set of pathways that come up the spinal cord and through the thalamus. They are ascending tracts, and the special fancy name for these tracts is what? Spinothalamic. Yeah, so this is a pathway of pain and temperature that comes up through your spinal cord. It is ascending in nature, called the spinothalamic pathway. And so that information is routed through your thalamus and then up to the appropriate portion of your somatic sensory cortex. Now, in which lobe is your somatic sensory cortex?
Parietal.
Parietal, good. So if you happen to stub your left toe, which hemisphere is going to receive that information? The right, yes. That's contralateral control. Remember, we've got our left side controlled by the right side, sensory input and motor output. So contralateral control, opposite sides of the body, controlled by opposite hemispheres of the brain. Other interesting stuff about the thalamus, it is also involved with the hypothalamus in the wake and sleep cycle. You know, when we stay stimulated by electronic devices and TVs and music and that kind of thing, then our thalamus stays awake, routing that sensory information out to our parietal lobe of the brain. But, you know, if you shut off those devices and have quiet and darkness, the thalamus has nothing to relay, so it then too can go to sleep. So you've probably often heard that if we stay stimulated with lights and noise, it's very hard to shut down and go to sleep. And that's because the thalamus is a routing or a relay center for incoming sensory info. Okay, so what are the three parts of the diencephalon? Good. Thalamus, hypothalamus, and pituitary gland. And which one of those houses endocrine system control?
Pituitary.
Pituitary, good. Which one controls hunger and food and homeostasis control?
Hypothalamus.
Which one is a routing station for incoming sensory information like pain and temperature? Thalamus, good. Okay, so just to review this brain portion, we did this last Wednesday. We talked about this kind of looking like a duck's head. That crest up there is the corpus callosum. Down below, this big piece right here is the thalamus. Below, where you've got the beak, is where we have the hypothalamus. And unfortunately, this picture cuts off the pituitary gland. All right, so we know that thalamus, hypothalamus, and pituitary should hang from that infundibulum right there, are all closely related together. Let's turn our attention to the brainstem. What three parts are housed in the brainstem? Good. Medulla oblongata, pons, and midbrain. And a lot of this is about automatic control. All right, so in a picture like this, you'll notice the piece that bulges out is the pons. Below that is the medulla, and then the midbrain is actually four little bumps. You can see two of them right there. Those four little bumps are called the corpora quadrigemina, literally translated the body of four twins. So the midbrain is actually first as you're coming down, then the pons, and then the medulla is the most inferior of those three portions. Okay, so which one of these three portions is a control center for the cardiovascular system, breathing?
Medulla
oblongata, good. What are the other two control centers housed there?
Midbrain is reflex.
Yeah, vasomotor centers housed in the pons, or medulla, and emetic. Yeah, emetic, so vomiting center. So medulla has four control centers. They are cardiovascular,
respiratory,
emetic, and vasomotor, good. So in Bio211, we're going to talk a lot about the cardiovascular and vasomotor centers. We'll talk more about the respiratory center, less so about that vomiting center. But this is one of the reasons why the medulla and the hypothalamus have no blood-brain barrier. We need direct access to what's traveling in your bloodstream in case we need to induce vomiting, for instance, or to regulate heart rate, breathing, or blood pressure. All right, so medulla and pons are closely related in terms of the breathing aspect. Breathing and the control of respiration rates is housed in your pons. Okay, so when I think about pons, I think that's the primary function. Breathing is the primary job here. And then finally, the midbrain are these four little bumps here on the back side of the brain stem. Those four little bumps are the corpora quadrigemina that form that midbrain. And what are the functions of those four little bumps?
Reflex
center. Reflex center, good. So they say it's an auditory and visual reflex center. So this helps to coordinate your eyes and your ears and what's being sensed together by those. You know, blinking is housed here in the midbrain. Your tympanic membrane and the reflexes, if you hear a loud noise, are housed here in the midbrain. If you're startled by a loud noise, that is also routed through the midbrain. So, you know, when you're startled and you jump, that's your midbrain responding to a really loud noise. So reflex centers are housed here in that midbrain. Okay, so a lot of info packed into that page. Can I help you with any parts of it or go back through any of it for you? We'll probably do this again Wednesday. You know, I notice a lot of you are checking your course packs when I ask a question, so I know it's not yet to that comfort level that it needs to be for next Monday's test. So why don't we repeat these pages again come Wednesday, just to make sure we're starting to get that stuff to stick. Okay, so that is page 116. Let's take a look at page 117 with the limbic system. So there's a part of your brain called the limbic system, and it has two new pieces or components. You'll notice there, this is located beneath the cerebral cortex. It includes the hippocampus, amygdala, and other structures. So when you're looking at this, you may say, well, I recognize the corpus callosum, and right underneath it, there's that eyeball-shaped thalamus. But then if you look around that whole area, there's a piece going around like this, kind of loops all the way around, and that includes the amygdala and the hippocampus. And so this region, you might say, is a portion of your brain that houses some very primal reactions. You know, sometimes somebody will say something to you, and you just have this gut response where you blurt out what you think, and you think later, why did I say that? I didn't mean to come across that way, or you think, I want to screen that before I pop out and say something. And that's your limbic system having a gut response. You'll notice some of the things that come out of this system are affection and rage, you know, two very strong feelings that we have. Sorrow, pleasure, even sexual interest all come from this region. So if you have a gut response to a situation, that's most likely being housed through that amygdala and hippocampus in the limbic system. Interesting stuff about this very old part of your brain. It is hardwired into smell. So all the other senses, seeing, hearing, tasting, what you feel is routed through your thalamus and then out to the particular part of your somatic sensory, your other cortexes, but not smell. Smell does not go through your thalamus for routing. Smell goes directly to which lobe of your cerebral hemisphere?
Temporal.
Yeah, it goes directly to your temporal lobe. So when you smell something that triggers a memory or a thought, that is going directly to that memory processing part of your brain, and it brings back a thought. For instance, if you had a beloved grandparent that wore a certain kind of perfume or cologne, you can smell that on somebody 5, 10, 15, 50 years later, and boom, you've got that memory that comes back into your brain. That's the limbic system that reactivates that sensation for you. So, interesting system here. It is an old part of your brain. It is hardwired into that area around the amygdala and hippocampus that wraps around the corpus callosum and around the bottom side of that hypothalamus. And this is where you've got a gut response system. You automatically respond. You don't process it through the prefrontal cortex. You don't think it through. You just automatically respond. That's really what this particular system will arouse in you. Okay. Any questions on the limbic system? This is another really interesting system. It's called the RAS for short. It's the reticular activating system. So what part of your diencephalon is a routing or a relay station? Thalamus. Yep, thalamus is your routing or your relay station. So this is actually part of where that reticular activating system is housed. It's housed partly in your thalamus. And your thalamus, before it sends on information, is going to filter what it sends. So, you've heard of hypnosis, right? So, guess what part of your brain they tell to stop filtering when you're hypnotized? Thalamus, yeah. So, this particular system says, hey, every sensation you're going to experience goes right through your thalamus, it stops filtering, and all of these sensations flood your brain. So really fascinating stuff here, because they found out back in the 1960s and 70s that LSD, a drug, also shuts off your reticular activating system. People experienced hallucinations. They saw these rainbows of colors. They felt like they were very in touch with everything. Well, sure, they were experiencing everything that their body had to offer. And so, of course, when that drug was in their system, it went right to their thalamus, shut off the filtering device, and all these sensations come through the thalamus and then out to your brain. So, interesting stuff about LSD. They have now found today that they can give it in very small quantities to people, especially men, who experience cluster migraines. And cluster migraines are debilitating, they're extremely painful, and they're often on one side of the brain or the other. And so, you know, lo and behold, you would think that a drug like LSD might not have any medicinal purposes, but they're finding that in very limited quantities that they can help use it for migraine treatments. So kind of a cool thing there. You know, if you're talking about hypnosis with the reticular or RAS system, people who are open to suggestions like stopping smoking or changing their diet or changing their behavior, if they're willing to participate with that, then they're more likely to have hypnosis change the way that thalamus is going to route information coming through. But really an interesting part of the brain, it too is an old portion that helps to filter out excess and unnecessary information. For instance, you're not aware of the clothes that you're wearing. I know you're consciously aware that they're on your body. You'd certainly know if you were sitting in class naked, right? Okay. But if you are, you know, wearing shoes, socks, jewelry, whatever, you're not consciously processing, I've got on shoes every second of every minute. Your RAS is going to filter out that kind of unneeded information. So only if the system changes information, like if your shoes become really tight for some reason, then you start noticing that, and now your brain is going to be aware of that information. So think of this reticular system as a place where we filter out unnecessary and extraneous sensory information. So two interesting systems there. Do you have any questions on the top of that page? I'm going to leave page 118 for you all to read over at your leisure. I don't usually put anything from that page on the test, but it's worthwhile information, because if you're going into a healthcare field, you're going to want to have the language to be able to talk about these disorders. So you'll want to look over page 118 just kind of as an FYI for your career pathway.
Page what?
That is 118. It says brain and spinal cord problems at the top. And 119 is just a practice page for you, so that wraps up brain and spinal cord information. Looks like we're ready to start on page 120 with chapter 14. Okay, so this chapter is the last one that's on the test next Monday, and this particular chapter covers two big topics, autonomic nervous system and somatic nervous system. I'm glad we've got a little time on Wednesday to review, because this may be a topic that you just want to hear again, just to help it get cemented into your brain. So let me tell you where we've been. We've been through the brain and spinal cord. They're parts of our central nervous system. That's where decisions are made. We've talked about some cranial nerves. They do branch off your midbrain, your diencephalon, the lower portion of your brainstem region. And we spent some time discussing how those spinal nerves branch off. We're going to now focus on the motor division, and then in a few minutes we'll talk about the sensory division. But we're now working on how we get information back out to your glands, muscles, and organs. We're working on how we tell them what they need to do. So if you're talking about skeletal muscles, we're going to take that information by the brain to the spinal cord, out spinal nerves, and then through a branch of nerves called the somatic nervous system. How do you communicate with, say, smooth muscle in your digestive organ? Yeah, autonomic, right. So automatic control that goes to smooth muscles or cardiac muscles, glands that secrete or other organs, they're going to get their information from a different set of nerve pathways. Those nerve pathways follow under this autonomic nervous system. You'll notice that we have a sympathetic and parasympathetic division. They are housed under that autonomic division. They're automatically controlled. Okay, so you don't necessarily control autonomic nervous system through your thoughts and your consciousness, but rather through an involuntary or automatic pathway. So just to kind of tie this all together, right now we're focusing not on the sensory input, but we're talking about how you get motor output control. So we're talking about voluntary motor control, and we're going to talk about involuntary or automatic motor control. All right, so which one of these two groups here, somatic or autonomic, controls skeletal muscle activity?
Somatic,
good. Okay, so somatic motor control originates in your brain. Let's get you a picture there. And do you remember which cortex of the brain or which lobe of the brain houses voluntary motor control? Frontal, good. Good. Frontal lobe houses that motor control. Now, to be very specific, what part of your frontal lobe houses the primary motor cortex?
Precentral gyrus.
Yeah, precentral gyrus. Good. So in this picture over here, they've placed a couple of neurons there in that precentral gyrus. That precentral gyrus is in the frontal lobe, and it houses primary motor control of your skeletal muscles. When you decide that you want to move any part of your body consciously, that nerve impulse initiates here in your cerebral cortex. It travels down through your brainstem, down here through your spinal cord, and then when we reach the appropriate level of your spinal cord, we then send a nerve impulse out to the appropriate skeletal muscle for contraction. So when you're looking at this pathway looks like it includes just a few neurons here. That means that skeletal muscle control happens to be really fast. If you think it, you can move it. That's about how fast this motor control is. When you're talking about autonomic motor control, you'll notice that the control originates in what part of your diencephalon? Yeah, hypothalamus. So automatic motor control that controls smooth muscles, glands, organs like the pancreas, for instance, that originates in the hypothalamus. It too comes down the spinal cord, out an appropriate spinal nerve, and then this pathway is a little slower because we've got multiple neurons involved in the pathway. So first off, we know that the skeletal muscles are controlled by your somatic nervous system. It's voluntarily controlled. This is a fast system because we use only one neuron. It's a one-way system or a one-neuron system there. So all of our skeletal muscles are controlled by this pathway. And we know control initiates in that primary motor cortex. What lobe does that sit in? Frontal lobe, yeah. So frontal lobe houses that primary motor cortex. So that is how we control our voluntary skeletal muscles. By contrast, ANS stands for automatic or autonomic nervous system, and it's involuntary. You'll notice it controls smooth and cardiac muscles. It's a slower system because it's a two-neuron system. So we're going to talk about what it means to be one neuron or two neurons in just a moment. And keep in mind, we've already talked about the hypothalamus being the control center for your ANS, so that's where the control of your glands, muscles, organs that are under involuntary control originates. So before we keep on going, there is 12 questions at the bottom of the page. You want to answer them all? Okay. Number one, what's the difference between a nerve and a tract? Its location. Tracts are in the CNS only. That means nerves are located where? PNS, good. So location makes a difference. Tracts are in the CNS. Nerves are in the PNS. Okay, what about a ganglion? What is that? PNS, good. Collection of cell bodies in the PNS. Ganglion is a collection of cell bodies in the PNS. Lateral horns and ventral horns carry motor information, but what type of motor info? That's right. Lateral's involuntary motor control, and you're right, ventral is somatic or voluntary motor control. Good. So lateral horns carry involuntary motor control. Lateral horns carry involuntary motor control.
Involuntary.
Glands, cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, anything that's automatically controlled.
Is it autonomic?
That's autonomic, yeah.
We could use the autonomic instead of.
You know those interchangeably because on the test I may call it autonomic nervous system or I may say it's involuntary control. Ventral is somatic, yeah, and that's control of skeletal muscles. Okay, so lateral horn, to summarize, is involuntary motor control that houses autonomic nervous system motor control. You can call it ANS for short. The ventral horn houses voluntary or somatic motor control. That is control of what type of muscles?
Skeletal.
Good. Let's see, number four, we've got sensory and motor. Which one carries information toward your central nervous system?
Sensory.
Sensory, good. Sensory carries information toward your CNS. Okay, where does motor carry information? Away from your CNS. Good. So motor carries information away from your CNS. I didn't, because I'm a little lucky to not hear. Number five, those terms are really similar to number four, afferent and efferent. Well, afferent means toward what? Toward the brain, right. So we can simply say toward the CNS means afferent.
With an A.
Efferent with an E reminds me of E for exit, because we are exiting and going away from your CNS. Efferent with an E means away from your CNS. How about number six, difference between voluntary and involuntary? Good. Yeah, voluntary we can consciously control. Voluntary we can consciously control. Involuntary, we cannot consciously control. Okay, what about white matter? Myelinated, good. White matter is myelinated. That means it contains a myelin sheath, and that myelin sheath has what impact on nerve impulses?
Makes it
faster, that's right. So quicker or faster nerve impulses result from myelination. So for number seven, white matter means you have myelinated neurons, and that myelin sheath increases the speed of nerve impulse transmission. Gray matter is what?
Unmyelinated,
good. So gray matter lacks a myelin sheath. Unmyelinated means lacking a myelin sheath. So what about the speed of nerve impulse transmission over gray matter? It's slower, good. Number nine, autonomic and somatic functions. How do they differ? Good. Bingo, that's it. Autonomic is involuntary. Autonomic is involuntary functions. Somatic is voluntary. Good. So I think you're starting to see that the nuisance with this stuff is they have one name and another name and another name, and it all refers to the same thing. And you think somebody's talking about something different. No, they're actually talking about all the same thing. So autonomic, involuntary, automatic, you know, all that stuff is the same stuff. It is. It is. So you guys probably are familiar with acetylcholine. It helps to make muscles contract. It's a neurotransmitter. Good. So acetylcholine is a neurotransmitter. And you may recall that synapses are the place where neurotransmitters are used. What message do they carry across the synapse? They tell the muscle to do something, right? Usually to contract. Okay, and we're going to talk about how that works, when that works in this chapter. So for number 11 there, what happens is at a synapse, neurotransmitters often travel across to the target cell. Neurotransmitters travel across the synapse to a target cell. To a target cell. Okay, so number 11, a neurotransmitter travels across the synapse to a target cell. And finally, number 12 is a repeat of something we've already covered. Where do you find visceral and somatic motor neurons in the gray matter? Let's take visceral. Where do you find visceral motor neurons in the gray matter? The lateral horns, that's right. So visceral is found in the lateral horns of the gray matter. Somatic is found in the ventral horns of the gray matter. Any questions on those terms? Ventral. Mm-hmm. So I feel like we've had to go through and learn a foreign language just to tackle this chapter. You'll notice when you turn the page with me at the very top of page 121, we are looking at the autonomic nervous system, and we're looking at an efferent pathway. Is that a motor pathway or a sensory pathway?
Motor.
It is motor, good. And since we're looking at the autonomic nervous system first, are we talking voluntary or involuntary?
Involuntary,
good. Okay, so let me tie this in and give you the big picture here. When you decide, well, you actually don't decide, your brain decides that you've got a problem with your heart rate or your blood pressure. There's a portion of your brain in the medulla that initiates a nerve impulse that travels down your spinal cord, and when we reach the appropriate part of your spinal cord, that nerve impulse is going to exit your spinal cord and travel out a spinal nerve. So if we're going to talk about innervating your heart, you know, for instance, or maybe your lungs or some other body part that we're controlling, then all of that involuntary control initiates somewhere in that brainstem diencephalon region. So we don't have conscious control over all those body parts that are controlled involuntarily or through this autonomic pathway. So you'll notice here that we're coming off at a lateral horn once we reach the appropriate portion of your spinal cord. That lateral horn is going to house motor neurons for which branch, ANS or SNS? ANS, right. ANS stands for autonomic nervous system. Is that the voluntary or the involuntary branch?
Involuntary.
So whatever automatic event your body's trying to control, it comes down to that portion of your spinal cord. We then let the nerve impulse travel out through a spinal nerve, and you'll notice that spinal nerve eventually makes its way to an effector organ. We can use the pancreas here as an example. So this particular pathway that we're going to follow involves an automatic, or involuntary pathway of motor control. We want to tell the pancreas to do something, or at least the part of your brain that's under autonomic control is going to tell your pancreas to do something, not something you consciously decide. Now, this is called a two-neuron system. There is a neuron traveling from your spinal cord to this dotted thing here called a ganglion, and there's a second neuron traveling from the ganglion to the effector organ. So we're going to name these neurons the preganglionic neuron and the postganglionic neuron. Okay? So the black dot here represents the cell body. This long piece here is the axon. There's your axon terminals. All of that belongs to our preganglionic neuron. The postganglionic neuron has a cell body inside that ganglion. That's the black dot there. It has an axon traveling away. And the axon comes over here and innervates the effector organ. There's the axon terminals. So our postganglionic neuron originates in the ganglion and innervates our effector organ. Postganglionic neuron exits our ganglion and innervates our effector organ. So this is called a two-neuron system. There's a postganglionic neuron and a preganglionic neuron. A few minutes ago, when we looked at this chart, we said that the autonomic nervous system control tends to be slow, and the reason for it is we use a two-neuron system. Now, this is actually a lie. You're going, what? Okay, so this ganglion we just defined on the previous page, it's a collection of cell bodies in the PNS, right? Okay, so this circle right here that has all these dots in it is representing our ganglion. That ganglion may house hundreds of neurons. So if you're talking about the numbers of synapses that we have to travel through, well, it's not just from the preganglionic neuron to the ganglion to the postganglionic neuron. There are hundreds of synapses inside that ganglion that we have to synapse through. Oh, okay, now it makes sense why you've got a slower system here. You're actually synapsing through two major neurons and hundreds in between. So this is going to take a lot longer to get the job done, to get the message to your effector organ. So just keep that in mind. Two-neuron system means pre- and post-ganglionic neuron with likely hundreds of neurons in the ganglion in between. Okay, go ahead.
Automatic. Say all their names.
Autonomic, automatic, involuntary, visceral. And then if we're talking about smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, glands, and organs, all that falls under those four terms. Efferent with an E simply means it's motor control, but it doesn't specify which type, whether it's automatic, or somatic. Okay.
Can you go back to the picture?
Sure.
So the dot is the cell body and the line is the
axon.
But the whole thing is the preganglionic neuron.
Correct.
Dot.
Yeah, from the dot over here to these little axon terminals, yeah, that's your pre, and then, of course, your post.
Okay.
Let's talk about your somatic nervous system. We know that somatic nervous system controls voluntary events like skeletal muscles. Now, this time we know that the conscious control of your muscles originates in your precentral gyrus. What lobe of your brain?
Frontal.
Frontal lobe, good. We send that information down your spinal cord. We cross the great commissure because this is contralateral control. And then we head out a set of nerves on the opposite side of your body from where the control originated. So if I want to move my left hand, the control originates on the right frontal lobe, goes down my spinal cord, crosses over the great commissure, and out the spinal nerve that controls my hand. So you'll notice that this is an honest-to-goodness one-neuron system. Notice the nerve impulse control originates here in your ventral horn of your gray matter. There's the cell body, the axon terminals innervate that skeletal muscle. And notice there is no ganglion here, okay? There is no ganglion in your somatic nervous system. What would the ganglion do to the speed of the nerve impulse anyway?
Slow it down.
Yeah, to slow it down. So we want nerve impulses to go immediately to your skeletal muscles. You know, we've joked about if you think it, you can move it, that's how fast this must be. So there is no ganglion in somatic nervous system control. No ganglion and somatic. It would slow down the nerve impulse. Questions so far? Any words confusing so far? Anything I need to clarify before we keep on trucking?
If there was one, it would slow down the nerve impulse.
Yeah, if there's a ganglion, it would slow down nerve impulses. Okay, let's, I know this is thick stuff, isn't it? Let's talk about this picture one more time because we're going to look at page 122 right now. Just want to make sure we're on the mental same page together. So when we're talking about ANS control, are we talking voluntary or involuntary control?
Involuntary.
Good. So what kinds of things in your body might you control through this pathway?
Heartbeat.
Breathing. Sweating, yeah. Glands, muscles, organs, all that involuntarily controlled stuff. Is this motor or sensory control that we're talking about?
Motor.
Motor, right. So we're talking motor control here. Would that be an afferent or an efferent pathway?
Efferent.
Efferent. That's what I usually say too. Okay, and so with your efferent pathway, you notice there is a ganglion here, and that ganglion may contain hundreds of neurons. So that's why this is a slower system than your somatic nervous system. Why do we call this a two-neuron system, even though there's hundreds involved? What's that?
It has two nerves.
Yeah, you've got two primary nerves. You've got a preganglionic nerve or neuron and a postganglionic. Good. Okay, so keeping that in mind, let's talk about what it means to have two divisions of your autonomic nervous system. These are the parasympathetic and sympathetic branches. Yeah, we're on the top of page 122. Yeah. Both are efferent because they're motor. Yeah, both are E. In fact, all of page 121, all of page 122 is efferent or motor control. And then we'll say 123. We won't talk about that one today. So 121, 122 are both motor or efferent control.
E.
Yeah. So if you've ever been driving down a highway or maybe even riding in the car with somebody who's been driving, you know, you get warm in the car, you get sleepy, your eyes start drifting shut, and the next thing you hear is a horn from a really big truck blaring at you. And so whether you're driving or not, you're wide awake, your heart's beating, you're alert, you're like, what happened? And, you know, of course, you're now afraid that you might have been going into oncoming traffic and there was an 18-wheeler heading in your direction. So what made you suddenly wide awake?
The sound.
Sympathetic. Yeah, so your sympathetic nervous system is going to respond to the sound, the sight, the excitement and emergency of the situation. And you'll notice your sympathetic nervous system is a branch of your autonomic division. So keep in mind, autonomic nervous system controls motor events involuntarily. And what you just experienced by driving into the head-on traffic was a sympathetic response. So let's talk about how you feel after you've had an experience like this. You'll have increased mental alertness. Your metabolism will increase. You may notice that your respiration rate increases. Your respiration passageways will dilate to get more oxygen in. Your heart rate will even increase. Your blood pressure will increase. You may notice immediately that you're sweaty. And during this time period where you're experiencing this fight or flight response, you're going to basically put your digestive and urinary functions on the back burner, because this is a life or death matter that must be resolved. And if you're digesting a hamburger that you just ate, life or death does not matter whether you digest that hamburger, right? Life or death means that you handle the situation in front of you. It's a fight or flight response to handling this emergency situation. So for that reason, digestion and urinary activities kind of slow down, and we focus the blood flow up here to our thoracic cavity. Let me put this in a bigger picture perspective for you. We have around 5 liters of blood that we circulate throughout our body. And if you're having an emergency, you want those 5 liters to be channeled to the areas where it makes a difference for you to live or die. So we're going to channel that blood to our thoracic cavity. We're going to send it to our brains. We're going to increase the heart rate and blood pressure to maintain blood flow to our body's vital organs. But we slow down what's below our diaphragm. We don't really focus on digestion, urination, or any of those functions while we're experiencing a fight or flight response. So some things that will put you into the fight or flight mode, which is sympathetic response. Well, emergency is certainly one of those things. Excitement is another. Exercise will also do it. I've got a 10-year-old. She goes outside to play every day when we get home, and she goes outside and runs like a banshee for hours. You know, you've either done this yourself or you have your own kids that run like crazy, right? When it's time for dinner, she comes in. Does she want to eat dinner? Why not? Sympathetic stimulation, yeah. So, you know, if you exercise right before a mealtime, you're going to eat less simply because sympathetic nervous response decreases digestive and urinary activities. Hey, that's one way to lose weight, right? Take a walk before the meal, not after the meal. And then you've heard about these emergencies where moms lift their cars off their kids, 3,000 and 4,000 pound vehicles. That is this response here. They're sending blood to those muscles. Those muscles never knew what hit them, and so they can make this magical lift of a vehicle off the kid, and that is sympathetic control. Yep. So I think if E-activities is stimulating your sympathetic nervous system, that puts you into the fight or flight mode. That allows you to do these things that either let you live or die. That's the whole goal of this nervous system. So let's take it the other end of the extreme. After a really large meal, let's say Thanksgiving dinner, you know, people like to eat a large meal, they load up on their year's worth supply of food, and then how do you feel after that meal?
Sleepy.
Tired and sleepy, yeah, time for the nap. So when you've had a large meal, that induces the parasympathetic nervous system. We call this one our rest and digest system. Like I mentioned earlier, we have around 5 liters of blood. We have to channel that blood where it makes most of a difference. So if you had a really big meal, your body sends that blood to your digestive organs to help digest your food. That means there's less blood for your heart, your lungs, your brain. That's why we get sleepy, part of the reason. And of course, the blood is going to go to our digestive and urinary organs to promote their activities. So this time we've just flip-flopped the scenario. We decrease thoracic cavity activities and we increase abdominopelvic cavity activities. So we force the blood to go where it makes a difference in digesting our food. Notice the D activities that promote parasympathetic nervous system control. Digestion, well, a big meal will always make you relaxed and sleepy. Parasympathetic nervous system encourages defecation, which is a bowel movement. And diuresis is also encouraged, which is the formation of urine. So we encourage D activities under parasympathetic control. So some things to think about. You probably have heard that it's not wise to eat a really large meal and then go for a swim. Okay, so what is the scientific basis for that? You could throw up. What else?
Or a swim in an evening.
Yeah, what if you go and have a really big meal and then you jump in and go for a swim?
Well, I say on the beach, you won't have a cramp or you won't have the...
Maybe is it the
energy to fight? I don't know. What if you drown?
What if you drown? That's the thing. Yeah, because where's the blood going when you eat?
Digestive system,
yeah. And so if you're going to go in for a swim, you switch from digestive activities to exercise, and now you're trying to put the sympathetic nervous system in control, and so the blood is trying to go to your heart and lungs instead of to your digestive activities. So you've got this battle that's set up, and your body has to decide, okay, who wins? Well, if you're in the deep end of the swimming pool, I'm hoping your sympathetic nervous system wins the battle. That's the one that's going to keep you alive and get blood to your muscles and your brain and your heart and lungs. So that's the basis behind having a really big meal and doing some exercise. Your body has to then decide, where do I send the blood? What's the most urgent need to keep you alive? Okay. How about questions so far on sympathetic versus parasympathetic? Just want to introduce this. We're going to repeat it again on Wednesday. The very bottom of your page has the sympathetic and parasympathetic differences. Okay, so let's take sympathetic and read across on that little chart. So, you know, if you have a kid who's, you know, you got a minivan that's rolled onto a five-year-old kid, mom leaps into action and suddenly can lift that minivan off that child. That is a gut response to an emergency. That is sympathetic nervous system control. When we talk about a gut response to an emergency, look at where the nerves are stimulating the body. It literally is a gut response. These spinal nerves in the thoracic and lumbar regions are going to excite your heart, your lungs, and put to rest your digestive and urinary organs. That way the blood goes where it's needed, which is heart and lungs to pump out oxygenated blood to your muscles. And we don't digest the food for this time period. We put that kind of at rest. So during this emergency that we're dealing with, we have thoracic and lumbar spinal nerves that respond to this emergency. So yeah, it really is a gut response to an emergency. The length of fibers, well, since we're dealing with an autonomic nervous system branch here, we're dealing with, you'll notice, short preganglionic neurons and long postganglionic neurons. So that means the ganglion sits closer to the spinal cord. In this picture, you really can't tell the difference except for their color coding. In this picture, you'll notice the red are the preganglionic neurons, and then it transitions to black, and those are the postganglionic neurons. It happens to be different for sympathetic versus parasympathetic. Okay, so sympathetic has short, S for S, short preganglionic neurons. And then finally, you'll notice under the sympathetic nervous system's neurotransmitters, we will utilize acetylcholine, epinephrine, and norepinephrine. So those last two are new for us, acetylcholine and epinephrine and norepinephrine. Let's talk about the parasympathetic nervous system. If you've ever been really upset about something, I'm sure someone has consoled you and said, hey, let's just breathe, take a deep breath, you know, calm down, it'll be okay. And they've tried to talk you down from whatever's causing you such stress. When you're doing that, either for yourself or for someone else, you're putting your brain back in control. Notice during the parasympathetic nervous system, we have cranial nerves that are in control, and we have these very low down sacral nerves in control. So we call this a craniosacral segment. It's mind over matter that gets you through this stressful period and brings your heart rate, your blood pressure back down to normal and puts the control back here for your digestive organs. So when you're calming yourself down, you're doing breathing techniques, you're trying to be focused and calm, test day, right? Okay, it's mind over matter that puts you back into parasympathetic mode. Notice this time we're dealing with long preganglionic neurons. In this picture, they're red. And the very short postganglionic neurons sit right at the organ. So the ganglion this time sits closer to the organ. Totally opposite from what you saw back there with the sympathetic nervous system. But notice this time, the only neurotransmitter we use is acetylcholine. What does acetylcholine tell muscles to do?
Contract.
Good. So if we're talking parasympathetic control, do we want your heart and lungs to work harder or your digestive organs to work harder? Parasympathetic control.
Digestive,
yeah. Let those digestive organs work harder and work that food and urine through. So that's where the focus comes here with the parasympathetic and craniosacral segment. I know that last chart was complete Greek or foreign language to you, so we'll repeat that in here on Wednesday. Hey, good news is this. Page 123 and 124 is all that's left. So we will wrap that up on Wednesday. Do bring your questions for test number 4 or 3.